All right, everybody, good morning. I would normally be doing a Sunday coffee right now or on Post Zero with the boys, but today I had a guest who was so kind to kind of work out a time that we could have a little conversation today. And as the title says, it's a world away because we're both on different sides of the planet, and he has a very, very different perspective in the way that he's kind of seen things unfold over the last year. And yeah, we are coming up on a year on October 7th, which just, it feels like it was yesterday, and so much has happened between now and then, but I don't want to get caught up too much in that, at least not right now. So before we go live, before I bring the great guest on stage, why don't you go to the links below, make sure you follow him, everything he's got going on. His music's really, really good. Sometimes when people produce political, and I don't want to say his music's all political, but when you kind of focus in on something in your music, sometimes it comes off superficial, but no, I find his stuff to be absolutely fantastic, very enjoyable. I watched an interview where they played his music in the intro and outro and then listened to some of it on my own. I thought it was great. So I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that, but links below for all his stuff and links below for all my stuff deemed fit through the link below to let them know that the Matovic family sent you. Fox and Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout, and Tiger Fitness to get all these supplements that keep you all jacked and tanned. So without further ado, let's rock and roll.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10-1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
All right, everybody, and welcoming to the show, my dear friend, Doc Jazz. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Kyle. It's great to be on the show. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. Well, I kind of came across you because I had a tweet that hit a million views talking crap about Russell Brand about a week or so ago because his conversion looks incredibly performative. But I'm glad that you kind of came across my little viral tweet there and we kind of got to make this possible because I saw a lot of similarities between you and I, and I thought this might be a cool conversation. So why don't you let the audience know who you are and what you do?
All right. Wonderful. Yeah, that's exactly how we came across each other. And it was very funny and interesting. And I really liked that tweet. And you a little bit slammed your own tweet a few days later. You said, you know, I write a silly tweet and I get a million views. But I thought it was right on the money because Russell Brand, man, I mean, I've been criticizing him since a few years, like even before he went all, converted and everything, because he was turning away from what I thought was important stuff. And I thought he was just, you know, being cautious and, you know, a little bit of a coward. So I started to poke him a little bit about it. He probably never saw it because he's got, millions of followers. But anyway, yeah, me, I'm my name is Tarek, and my stage name is Doc Jazz. You said some really nice things about my music. I thank you for that. And the reason why my name is Doc Jazz is not because I make jazz, because you probably heard that my music isn't really jazz. It's kind of jazzy, maybe. But I make music, and I've been making music since my teen years, composing it mainly, also playing it, of course, but composing really became my thing right from the start when I started making music. And I'm self-taught. I little by little, I started, you know, learning more instruments, and then I thought, you know, I can combine them, and it was always my thing to like be the one man band in my little bedroom, you know, going from really lousy equipment, from, you know, recording between two tape decks and then bouncing and getting really poor sound quality. And slowly but surely, things became easier with digital recording, and I started to be able to put some better quality in the recording itself. I'm also, I think that's very relevant, and you can see the flag behind me. I'm Palestinian, born and raised in the Netherlands, and that's why I have, you know, I'm very much in touch with Western culture, even though I'm also very, very much in touch with Palestinian culture. So, I got maybe you could say the best of both worlds. That's could be a way of looking at it. At least music-wise, I would say I did get the best of both worlds. I really love rock. I really love funk. I really love jazz too. And I think like my mix, my music is kind of like a blend, my own type of blend between these three things. And there's quite a bit of every now and then a little bit of an Arabic sauce in it with Arabic instruments that I play that I blend into them. Didn't do that really on purpose, just because I thought that theme-wise, sometimes I felt, you know, if it's a song about Palestine, then in this type of song, I would want to feature a Palestinian instrument in it. Or sometimes I just felt that, you know, that the song would benefit from it. Mm-hmm. And this is how I blend these things, you know, into my, I think, kind of my own style of music. I work full-time as a surgeon. That's my my daytime job, a daytime and nighttime sometimes, you know how that goes. Mm-hmm. And somehow I managed to juggle all these things and still make a living and still stay alive. and you know, that's how I got here on Kyle's show.
Yeah, no, I totally get it, man, because I feel like I'm doing a lot of the same thing also. You know, I've played in the band that I've been in now for about 5 or 6 years. I'm a consistent athlete, or, you know, my wife complains when I say athlete. So, you know, big exercise enthusiast, diet, you know, kind of big health and fitness guy. And then on top of that, I also do all this, you know, libertarian stuff, love podcasting. I just kind of juggle all this stuff. And then of course my main job that pays the bills is being a mechanic. So when I see other people that are kind of like, all right, you know, throw the ball up. All right, now I'm a surgeon. All right, now I'm talking about Palestine. All right, here, and I'm a musician. I love this kind of stuff. A guy, jack of all trades.
Wow, man, I'm impressed.
People could say jack of all trades, master of none, but no, I look at that as somebody that's, you know, talented in many different things. And I think that, you know, guys should be a, you know, talented in multitude of things, because that makes you, you know, more appealing person. So one thing that's kind of interesting to me is that I think from the Western perspective, we kind of look at the Middle East as like, I don't mean this disrespectfully, but, you know, from the time that we're kids, I think we're kind of told that, oh, you know, these are all terrorist countries. They hate you for your freedoms. They're awful. But the more and more I talk to people from foreign countries, I mean, I've had guests on who live in Russia, China, I'm sure other places that I just can't remember off the top of my head. I find that like a lot of these different cultures are just a lot like ours, like almost, I don't want to say the same, but like, you know, they do a lot of the same stuff that we do. Like they have social media. Like it's not like they live in like prehistoric times. Like, no, they're actually very modern. It's just the way that they may eat, talk, or have, you know, culture around certain things is completely different. So I know you haven't always lived in Palestine, but I remember hearing you say that you've been to Palestine a bunch of times. So what is the kind of culture like in the Middle East, and how would you kind of communicate that to somebody who lives in the West like me, who's never really been over there?
Yeah, very interesting angle here there, Kyle. Let me tell you first how I see it, how I see this, you know, all these different cultures. I think that cultures arise from the historical background. So things that don't make sense to one person looking at somebody from the other culture is usually because they don't know where that came from. And oftentimes, even the people of the culture themselves don't know their culture, their history that well to understand where all their rules came from. But I don't think that cultures invent rules just because they want to invent rules and just because they want to make life difficult. Or it's actually the other way around. It comes from a time when those rules were absolute necessities for the culture to survive. And because different climates and different regions, different interactions with the cultures around them, geographical, could be, you know, could be what is available in terms of food. There's so many things, and all these things feed into all these different rules that people make, and that becomes what you call a culture. And then a culture is very dynamic. So I think that if you take a sample now of the China of 2024, but you would flip back 400 years, it's not only that they didn't have cars and high risers. You would also find that people think differently, because the way people think is also influenced by what they experience, what's available, what's possible, what's practical, what's dangerous, and all these things, you know, they influence how people live their lives, and that becomes what we call a culture. And then let's never forget that within a culture you have subcultures. So you have a subculture within, for instance, America. You have so many subcultures because it's a melting pot of people who come from so many different places. So they eat different things in different areas. But also, if you would say that, if you're into hard rock, for instance, or metal, that's a subculture in itself. You dress in a certain way. You talk maybe in a different way. Or in a specific way, and so you have subcultures, and I think that when we look at when we're in one country and we're looking at the other country, we tend to think that the other culture is monolithical, and because right. we tend to think that, if somebody wants us to hate these people or to have a certain idea about those people, it's pretty easy to feed into that because. The perception of the people is that they're monolithical anyway. So you can say, well, you know, they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you can take a whole subset of things, while what you're describing might be just like a tiny subculture of that culture. And then you could convince people that that applies to all the people in that culture, because you could take a few videos, you know, and you can even edit the videos, so you could leave out the stuff that contradicts what you're trying to sell.
Oh, they would never do that.
No, they wouldn't, would they? and then you know, you can propagate against a certain culture and create stereotypes, as we call them, and create expectations or ways that people view these people. Mm-hmm. And then to come back to what you originally asked, what's the Middle East like? Well, it's extremely diverse, extremely diverse. I mean, if you come to Dubai and then travel to Cairo and then travel to Baghdad and then travel to Damascus and then travel to Beirut, which I wouldn't advise at the moment, and then to Benghazi and then to Morocco, you're all in Arab Islamic culture, but you'll see huge differences. And even within one city, you could go to Beirut visit an area where if somebody just showed you the video footage, you'd think you're in Paris or in LA. And then you could take another shot, you know, in the same city, and you would think you're in somewhere very exotic and very Eastern, and where people dress in ways that you might not identify with, and where you would think, okay, now I'm actually really in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. So I think that people underestimate how diverse the Middle East is, and that the stereotypes that people have been fed in the West, they're way off. They're so way off. I mean, you can't even begin to imagine how off they are. And it becomes clear by itself if you start talking to these people. You know, if you start talking to people from those cultures, then you find out that your stereotypes don't match. You're like, wait a minute, that's not what I thought you were. That's not what I thought you would say. That's not how I thought you would think. And well, now you're talking to me, and I grew up in the Netherlands, and now I'm, in the Middle East, and I was raised very Arabic. I was my language, very fluent and everything. Mm. I strongly identify, I have a very strong Arab identity. But then I'm talking to you now, and you're like, hey, he doesn't have an Arabic accent, and he's talking about jazz and rock. What's Arabic about this guy? Well, you know, it's because it's because I'm talking to you, so I can, adapt the conversation to what we are talking about. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that you won't hear me saying some very Arabic things today. You mm-hmm. they might just not sound very Arabic, but they could still be very, very Arabic. And that's what makes this a very interesting conversation, I think. I hope so. We just started, so let's see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was blown away when I heard you speak for the first time. I was listening to an interview. I can't remember the channel. It was a British guy with blonde hair.
Yeah, Nick. That was Nick.
Yeah, I think that might have been his name. But yeah, it was a fantastic interview. And when I first started hearing you speak, I'm like, man, this guy has a wonderful voice. And he can speak very, very fluent English. And like normally, like I said, our Western perspective is that like a lot of people from the Middle East may not be able to but like aren't fluent in English. But then, like I said, the more and more I talk to people from all over the world, it's like, oh, no, these people are actually like, most people can speak pretty fluent English. I mean, one of my friends who I talk to almost every single day, he's from the Netherlands, and you know, he speaks very, very fluent English. Sometimes I'm like, wait, can I speak fluent English?
Of course.
Well, I am from Pittsburgh. People are like, oh yeah, you guys are saying like inns and downtown and Washer and all this stuff. So like, you know, we if you grow up in Pittsburgh, you don't think you have an accent, but then you go around the world and people are like, where the fuck are you from?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, to me, and I'm definitely not an expert on American accents, but I could never place you. You sound like, you sound like standard American to me. Okay, you don't sound Southern. Mm-hmm. You don't sound, you don't have that LA kind of like, you know, the floating thing. And you don't have the New York, the rough thing, the Brooklyn thing. So it sounds like just, this is how an American sounds to me. So I think you're doing great.
Good. Well, like I said, people think of their outside cultures as being so drastically different. But I have a friend who lives in Saudi, and you know, he speaks very, very fluent English. Now he still has a pretty heavy accent, but like, you know, he sent me some pictures of different places in Saudi, and it's like, hey, there's like snow, and it literally looks like somewhere there'd be like downtown Pittsburgh or something like that, where there's streetlights and trees and snow and stuff. Where, like I said, I think most people think like, oh no, it's just like sand everywhere with some buildings and stuff like that.
And don't just forget the camels. Don't forget.
Yeah, well,
the
there you go.
Yeah.
this might be a little bit crude, but we kind of pick on them a little bit and say, you know, I'm sure you guys couldn't have sex ed and driver's ed in the same day. That camel would get way too tired. It's all good fun though, but you know, he's very well educated in stuff like that. So I guess the next question would be, how do you know, Palestinian cultures and Middle Eastern cultures kind of view the West? Well, I guess that would almost be two separate questions, because and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like Palestinians almost look at like the West as something very evil because of what they've essentially enabled Israel to do, and then kind of other Middle Eastern countries, depending on where they kind of stand in relation to the U.S., may feel the same, or they may be a little bit indifferent. So am I wrong? Am I off base? You know, what's the perspective there?
Well, the interesting thing, and I think you'll find that when you talk to Palestinians, is and other Arabs, I think this is very general in Arabs, and maybe it's a reflection of let's say how we live here, feeling that, you know, let's say our governments don't always represent us. So we actually don't look, we don't have a very negative view of Westerners as people, as persons. I rarely ever hear any, and I, you know, I've been around Palestinians my whole life. I've never or rarely ever heard people speak very negatively about the people. So we're always talking about your governments. And yeah, we have a big bone to pick there, because we got totally screwed by the governments of the West, and we still are. And it's actually, been taken to a different level now, a crazy level, which is infuriating. Mm-hmm. But do you see on Twitter, do you see people, fulminating against Westerners as people? I don't think you do. And if you do, show me, because that means that they're probably there, but would they be more than 5 to 10%? I doubt it. It's just not how we're raised to think. Even we're not, it's a little bit strange to our culture to think in that way, and I think the reason for that is because if you look at the map, you see that the Arab world is the area that connects the three big continents of the old world. So plus, because we in Palestine, we have the holy city of Jerusalem, which is holy for three religions. And so many people of so many different cultures and ethnicities have been visiting that area for so long that we're not like, let's say, one small town in Siberia or a small town somewhere in, you know, somewhere in the middle of the prairie in America, where you never see somebody who isn't of your ethnicity. This is generations upon generations upon generations having interactions with other cultures all the time. And I think that that is where that tolerant view comes. In my opinion and in my perception, and then add to that the very deeply ingrained culture of Arab hospitality. Hospitality is really, I mean, there, I think many cultures are hospitable, but in our culture, hospitality is sacred. It's taken to a very, very high level of importance, which also has a history to it, but I don't think we should get too deep into that. But but it also plays a lot into that tolerance on the personal level. And that's why you find when activists went to Palestine, and you can see their testimonies, how they were received by the Palestinian people, instead of what you might think and what Israelis are trying to make them think. Oh, don't go there. They'll eat you alive. They'll kill you. They'll roast you, or they'll do
right. We keep hearing that people always say, oh, Queers for Palestine, they would throw these people off the roof. And I sincerely don't know, but I feel like there's a little bit of hyperbole, and this is still kind of like the George Bush, you know, war on terror propaganda telling you that as soon as you walk over there with a flag or something, you're going to get tossed out of a building.
You know, look, if you come into any place where your purpose is to provoke people, then you might piss people off. Yeah. But if you, yeah, I mean, if that's your purpose, I mean, you usually get what you're going for, right? So, right. But if you're just coming somewhere and, you know, and like you're Kyle and you would come to my village, man, you'd be spoiled. They'll bring you stuff you've never eaten, and they'll be talking to you. Everybody wants to talk to you. Everybody wants to hear your story. Everybody wants to, you know, show their hospitality to you. And everybody will be like, you know what? This guy is our guest, and this is really our culture. This guy is our guest. We're going to make him feel good. And when he leaves, we're going to have to give him the experience where he thinks, wow, these people are awesome. And this is not just what we do for Kyle. This is also what we would do for an Arab who comes visit our village. It's just in our culture to do that. And then coupled with the fact that it doesn't upset us that you have a different religion and that you think in a different way, that's just super interesting. So people will have very deep, curious conversations with you without, you know, without upsetting you or without making you get upset with them. Mm-hmm. So because you don't upset guests, you know, that's really against the code. If they would even see your facial expression just change a little bit, you look a little bit uncomfortable, they'll change the subject and, you know, and bring you an extra cup of tea or something sweet to eat. So that's just, you know, and sometimes I've studied Western people too. And maybe also because you guys have so many movies. And if I'm thinking of a rural countryside American town and a guest comes in there, I think they'll spoil the guest as well. So I think that that it isn't so weird for people to think to have this concept. I think it's an international concept. I think we're a bit we're a bit specialized in that, you could say, but what we don't really have much is a culture of intolerance, because it just doesn't fit with the history of our country.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because something I thought of there is that anytime my brother and I have someone here in, you know, near Pennsylvania where, you know, somebody from out of town, the first thing we think of is, oh, we got to take them to our favorite barbecue joint because they're going to love it. Let's get some brisket, ribs, burn ends or something like that. And, you know, maybe we can go get a cocktail or something like that. Like, we want to show them Pittsburgh or, you know, hey, let's go down to Mount Washington here in Pittsburgh and make sure we go at night and you could see where the three rivers meet and then all the lights, the city looks beautiful. Think about stuff like that. And it sounds like what you're getting at is that, hey, Palestinians and other Arabic cultures are kind of like, hey, you know, let's go, let's have them enjoy this certain, you know, meal or something like, or take them to this area. Like, there's not a lot of difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I really think, and it's not, I don't want to sound like, I don't know, you know, like the, you may say I'm a dreamer, hippie type of thing, yeah. But you know, people really are the same. And I'm saying that as a doctor mostly now. Look, mm-hmm. I've operated on people from, you know, all ethnicities and all mm-hmm. backgrounds, especially, you know, where I live now is very, very cosmopolitan. I get all nationalities, mm-hmm. but even before that. And then, you know, I mean, trust me, if I say on the inside, we're all the same. And I mean that literally.
Yeah. But I was going to say, if you're missing an arm, I'm pretty sure you don't care what that doctor looks like. You just care that you can put it back on.
Yeah. And also because, you know, somebody who has to undergo an operation is emotionally in a very vulnerable state because they're afraid. It's scary to undergo an operation. And you see that all these patterns of interaction are all the same. I mean, it requires the same type of attitude to calm somebody down and to reassure them about their operation, whichever nationality they are. You know, so I've learned to say you're going to be all right in a whole bunch of languages so that they can hear it in their own language. And somehow that always like, oh, hey, cool. So it triggers something in their mind. And then, you know, you get them to calm down. And also the family interactions, because they usually come with family and the family is worried about them. And, you know, it just shows you that people really are the same. They look a little bit different on the outside. The scientists can tell you that their DNA is like, you know, what you see on the outside is a phenotype. It's not a race. Mm-hmm. Races don't exist. That's what science says. And these phenotypes are just very small. They're reflected in a very, very small part of the genome. So we're really talking about nothing if we're talking about differences. As if we try to augment differences, we're actually walking away from reality and turning a blind eye to the truth. And the truth is that Kyle and Doc Jazz is, you know, it's not much difference there.
Yeah. So I guess one other thing I wanted to talk about while we're kind of on this topic of different cultures is we hear from people who are very, very pro-Israel all the time that, look at the Hamas charter that was put out back in the 80s. And they say they want to kill all Jews worldwide. But, you know, never mind the fact that the Israeli charter pretty much says, you know, all of, you know, from the river to the sea will be all Jewish territory. What do Palestinians generally think about Israelis? Are they more concerned about Israelis or are they more concerned about their government?
Okay, that's a good question, but I'll first answer what you said. You didn't really ask it, but I want to sure. comment on what you said about the charter. There are mm-hmm. two common lies about the charter. First of mm-hmm. all, the charter was amended in 2017,
correct,
in which it actually accepts the two-state solution. So mm-hmm. there you go. That's already blows a huge hole in the first point. Mm-hmm. The first point of the kill all the Jews, that's never written anywhere. They just make that up. Mm-hmm. So they make that up because they know that if they say the Hamas charter says that, nobody will actually go and look it up and check if that's actually written there. There mm-hmm. is nothing in the Hamas charter or in any Palestinian charter of any faction that says we need to kill all the Jews. In fact, what all the factions of Palestine have in common is that we differentiate between Jews and Zionists. And here's where we come to your actual question. Mm-hmm. We've historically there have been Jews in Palestine all the time, and mm-hmm. there's no history of any conflict with them. So if we hated them, well, then we had our chance because they were only 5% of the population. So we, you know, 95% can just gobble up the 5% and get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And that never happened because that mentality never existed, and that feeling never existed, and that hatred never existed. So if we hadn't been invaded by Jewish people from Europe and had 75% of the people kicked out, and that's why there are so many Palestinian refugees, and land appropriated, and the horrors that you're seeing now happening are similar to the horrors which happened in 1948 when they created the state. Mm-hmm. If that hadn't been done by Jews coming from Europe, but had been done by Chinese people or by African people or by any kind of people, we would be upset. And guess what? Anybody would be upset if that would be done to them by any kind of people. Mm-hmm. So, of course, because those Jews came from an area where there was apparently anti-Semitism, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not our problem that they want to project that on us. I think they're doing it on purpose. I don't think that they're doing that accidentally and that it's just like a psychological complex or anything. I think that they're doing that on purpose in order to try and make sure that they can exploit the guilt complex that they've installed in the people who did that to them. Mm-hmm. And kept it alive. And, you know, Finkelstein wrote The Holocaust Industry and all that kind of stuff. And I think that maybe not everybody, because, you know, the pundits of any movement dictate and others follow. So maybe not every person thought about it as deeply, but they echo what they're taught. And they're taught to tell everybody that we are savages and we want to kill them all. And the fact is, we don't. We're not interested in killing them, not even all. We're not interested in killing them at all. We are interested in having our country back. That we are. And if you say, well, you know, I stole it, and then you say, well, you know, if I'm not, if I don't steal it, somebody else going to steal it. You heard that very famous thing.
Yep.
You know, so what are we? What are we? A bunch of idiots who just take that lying down? Of course not. Then you're going to get us really angry. Then we're going to have resistance movements. And then we're going to do something about it, because the one.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Thing that people know now, after 76 years of our struggle, is that we're not a bunch of pussies, and we don't we don't let people walk over us. Mm-hmm. We don't decide that, you know, okay, you know, it's a little bit tough right now. We're so weak. They've got you know, the biggest armies in the world are supporting them. So you know what? Let's just do nothing. Mm-hmm. Nah, that's not us. We're fighting back. And and we're going to keep doing that. And that's what pisses them off the most, because they've done things to us that they thought, well, you know, normal human beings would have just, you know, dropped dead and said, okay, enough is enough. Let's run away. And and even though in 1948, that's kind of what happened, because we didn't have a belligerent history. We didn't have a history of, you know, being fighters or everything. But, you know, if you keep fighting us, persecuting us, not giving us a chance to breathe, not giving us a chance to walk anywhere, instill hatred of, you know, express your hatred over us as you're inferior, we're superior. Yeah, well, you know, you've made us into fighters. And now we're some of the fiercest fighters in the world. I'm proud of it, because we have a very good reason to be that. And there is nothing else that we should be right now. If we would choose to be anything else than that, it would be an insult to all the suffering of the 76 years that we've been suffering this already, and that would have all been for nothing. So it's our back against the wall, and you see our people fighting relentlessly and with very simple means against one of the strongest armies in the world. And it's a big tragedy, mostly because instead of aiming for our fighters, they like to aim for the weakest among us, which is, you know, the children. Mm-hmm. And they delight in killing our children, and it's just a horrible ideology that they're embracing. And I don't think that there's any way to change their minds except by fighting back. I think that's the only way. They're not showing us any other way. They're showing you also, look at the opinion polls and everything. Netanyahu, who is starting to be despised even by people who used to like him. They're just becoming so outrageously violent and delighting in the violence, you know. All those TikTok videos of dancing soldiers and gloating over even, you know, the killing of babies and children. These are not things that let's say ordinary humans around the planet,
right,
even in conflict zones, are used to propagating or bragging about. If they would do it, they would try to hide it because they know it looks bad. But these people are like, yeah, let's put it out there and let's show them how nasty we are, because then they'll fear us more or something like that. I don't know.
I was listening to a podcast recently where it was to Jewish Zionists, and it was kind of disturbing to me because they said, you know, we look at a Palestinian baby or something like that, and like, we don't give a fuck if that baby dies or something like that. Like, I just sincerely don't care. And to hear stuff like that, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I mean, and you always hear Zionists repeat this talking point that Israel does not target civilians. I'm like, you're bombing maternity wards. There are no functional hospitals left in Gaza. 90% of the people in Gaza have been displaced. At what point do you say they are purposefully targeting civilians at this point? I mean, like I said earlier in the show, it's going to be a year tomorrow since October 7th. And most people think that history started on October 7th. But, you know, you can only subjugate people for so long. And it's even funnier to hear Donald Trump say that this would have never happened under my watch. It's like, well, when you placate a whole bunch of governments and tell them, hey, just turn your heads away from what's going on to your neighbors that look, sound, talk, and probably are even related to you, eventually you're going to have to wonder, what are those people going to do when you just subjugate and, you know, just completely make them suffer for decades at a time? Eventually something's going to happen, and that something was October 7th. And on top of that, we still can't even hardly talk about the fact that Israel admitted to using the Hannibal Directive, which is a program where they kill their own people. So how many of those 1,200 people were killed by the IDF? I mean, we don't know. We don't have an answer for this. So, I mean, there's something to be tangled with here. Like, hey, Netanyahu propped up Hamas back in 2006, right? And they haven't had an election since. And it's really funny to hear people say, well, what culpability do Palestinians have for electing Hamas? If you want to apply that to everywhere else, because if you start applying that everywhere else, the implications are very, very, very ugly. And then on top of that, when you displace 90% of a people in somewhere that's the most densely populated area in the entire planet, what do you expect to happen? I mean, nothing good can come of this. And, you know, I've heard it a lot, but, you know, Israel really is making themselves a pariah. And, you know, personally, I'm not against the formation of a Jewish state if it's built on property rights where you negotiate with other Palestinians and say, hey, we're going to buy this property off of you if you agree to sell it to us. I'm okay with people doing that. When you kick people off their land and tell them you can't come back, and we have, you know, my great, 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 great grandmother lived here at one point, so therefore I can take your property, not have a problem. But once again, if it's, you know, on fundamental rights of just, hey, we're trading this, no problem. But that's not what's going on here. I mean, people were ethnically cleansed, and then now it's just, it is a genocide. I don't know how people can't look at this and say it's not a genocide when you have intent, you have displacement, and then you have explicit, you know, statements of, we are here to, you know, ethnically remove these people. And then even, you know, what Israel was euthanizing, what was it, Ethiopian babies who weren't of the same demographics as, you know, Israeli Jews. So I know I threw a lot out there.
Yeah. Not that I want to sound like I'm defending them, but that wasn't what was happening. They were giving Ethiopian women without their consent and without them even knowing what they were getting. They were giving them injections to stop IEDs. Them from having babies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pathological as well. That's psychotic. Correct. It's sick. Mm-hmm. But no, they weren't. They weren't just euthanizing live Ethiopian babies, as far as I know. But I wouldn't put it beyond them, considering how they feel about babies who are not of their kind,
right.
Because they are like savagely, really murdering them in ways that we've never seen before, and they're not shy about it. I heard you say something very interesting, which is. Which reminded me of Piers Morgan. I don't know exactly what you said, which triggered my memory of him. But when people are defending them, when people are trying to make it seem that what is happening is has some kind of an angle of justice, as he does, this is politicized. It's not. Right. I do not believe that people genuinely believe that. Mm-hmm. They just, I mean, especially if they're not of that, of their ilk, you know, if they're like a guy like Piers Morgan, I don't think that he really believes that. He just wants to sell that message because he knows that it puts him, in a very lucrative position. And that's why he plays the game the way he does. And he's far from the only one who does that. Mm-hmm. I think that what is very important when people are talking about Zionism, it's very important to differentiate between the so-called Christian Zionists, the evangelical Christian Zionists, and the Jewish Zionists. It's very important because the evangelicals don't have a personal stake in the land. Mm-hmm. They don't want to come and take my place. I said that in the other interview as well. They don't want to come to my village and say, okay, you guys, you all go, and I'm bringing all my Christian families here, and you're all going to go, and we're all going to throw you into Jordan. Mm-hmm. They're not doing that. They are supporting the people who are doing that.
Right.
Okay? And so there is the crook, and then there is the henchman of the crook. So people want to reverse that. I don't know what their agenda is of wanting to reverse that. They're even trying to give some bogus historical context for that. But no, Zionism is Jewish. And the people who are trying to make it seem like it isn't, I think they have a reason for wanting to make it seem that way. Mm-hmm. And the evangelicals were lured into it. You know, you probably know the Scofield Bible. And you know, they were dragged into it, and that was a time in history when that happened, and they were very successful at doing that. So, for me, I mean, and also I met a lot of Americans, right wing conservative Americans who used to be evangelicals who were raised that way. These people, when their eyes are opened. And when they're done with that, and when they're like, okay, give me a real Bible now, okay, and now let me be a real Christian for now, and I don't want to do this weird version of Christianity, and they return to themselves, and they see Israel almost identically to how I see it. So that is a very big step, and there is no self issue in there. So yes, there are Jews who were raised Zionists and who are now not Zionist anymore, but they still have their family to deal with, you know, and the ex-evangelical as well, but it's not connected to a land, you know, it's not connected to a land theft where they have to struggle that. I feel sorry for the ex-Zionist Jew because they have, you know, I mean, they're like a traitor to their family. Right. That's very hard. And I think that the ex-evangelical can, you know, can still have some leeway because you know, the stakes aren't that high. It's not about land. I don't know how that goes. Maybe you can tell me more about that. But I feel that they come a much longer way when they become more anti-Zionist, in my view, than the ex-Zionist Jew.
I feel
that way. That's my experience.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if I'll necessarily be able to answer that question, but the people that are closest to me that are very religious are Orthodox Christians, and they're probably the best people that I know that are religious on the whole Israel deal, because they always are the first ones to point out, like, no, this is not the biblical Israel. The biblical Israel is the church, is in, like, that's where you spend time, that's where you worship. And really, I think that a lot of the Israeli project really was to take advantage of people's religious beliefs, because, I mean, this is something very, very deep to people. I'm agnostic, but I have great respect for people's religious beliefs, because I understand, like, this is something that you're taught. And you were kind of saying in the beginning about, like, cultures, and basically what I was getting from what you were saying earlier is, like, there were a lot of fences put up for good reason. And this is kind of the way that I look at a lot of religion, is that, like, there are biblical rules that were probably made throughout time that people are like, oh, well, if we have a religious context, then we can pass this down for generations as best practices. And it generally forms a culture that's worth preserving. That's kind of the way that I've always looked at it. And it seems to work well for people. So I have great respect for that. But when it comes to, like you said, the Scofield Bible, and when you start to get the dispensationalism, I think that's taking advantage of people's very, very, you know, good and well-meaning beliefs to get them to believe in something that is, in my opinion, very unethical, and support a government that you can't question. Because what do you get as soon as you're anti-Israel? You just hate Jews. You just hate this. You just hate that. And really, that's kind of a disgusting sentiment, because it's like, no. Because I have friends that are Jewish people that, you know, aren't Zionists. And I have friends that are Jewish that don't believe in Israel as it is. So to conflate, like, Jewish people as the government of Israel, or as Israel as a whole, to me, that's a very, very sloppy, you know, hodgepodge of bullshit that just isn't true, because that's, once again, a lot of people reject that that's the actual Israel. My understanding is that, once again, Israel's the church, as in it's where people go to worship and pray, you know, on their own. Like, that's not the state. It's just, and like I said, it looks like to me that that's put there to make people not question it, because, once again, what do you always get? You just hate Jews. I've gotten it so many times. Like, I know, like, one Jewish person. You know what I did for this guy? I helped him rebuild his retaining wall, and he bought me KFC, and we worked together for years, and I didn't even think that anything about his ethnicity or his religion. I didn't care. Guess what? I still don't.
Well, you know, and I think that that this projection, like for instance, today, some guy, you can find him on my Twitter list, never heard of him, just, you know, one probably insignificant columnist somewhere. I don't even know where it was, but they took a screenshot of what he published today. And he said that he was, the title of it had something with blood libel. Okay. And he said that the blood libel is something which has, you know, has been used throughout centuries to accuse Jews of, you know, killing babies, and that this myth is kept alive by the, let's say, the propaganda of the pro-Palestine movement. And I mean, rarely has a headline infuriated me more than that. So you're saying that all the babies of Gaza who were murdered, that all didn't happen? This is just a myth? This is the myth of the blood libel? You are not actually killing children? While every human rights organization can give you the statistics of how many children you killed. Not only that, we don't even need those. Every X user, Twitter user, has seen videos of it. What are you talking about? Calling something that people have seen with their own eyes a myth is just that playing that game again, trying to hit that string, and the string isn't tuned well. It sounds horrible. trying to hit that string again, which makes everybody feel uncomfortable. And then like, oh, okay. No, sorry. No, that's not what I mean. So every time you're pushed into a defensive position where you have to say that you're not anti-Semitic. And that's why I think the right tactic for that is to never say that you aren't. I mean, you also shouldn't be one. And you also shouldn't say that you are one. But I think you should never say that you're not, because it's not. I mean, that's exactly what they want. They want you to be in the defensive position. And I think that you should be in the attacking position, because when there's a genocide going on, the people who are committing the genocide deserve to be attacked, must be attacked. They must be the target of scorn, you must ostracize these people until they repent, until they say, okay, you know what? We took things too far. We don't want to kill babies. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying these are Amalek. These are, according to the Bible, we have to kill them even in the wombs of their mothers. If this is what you believe, then you can't expect to be part of the world community. Because first of all, if Amalek is in the Bible, you're making the people now being Amalek. That's just your choice. If that happened in the past, and if that was what needed to be done, and it was done, we don't even want to talk about it anymore. But if you're taking it from the Bible or from the Old Testament and making that the rule of today, that's on you. That's not on the Bible. That's on you yourself. And you, I'm not Amalek. I've never even heard of that name. My name isn't Amalek. The name of my people isn't Amalek. You're deciding. You're deciding because you want to, purely because you want to, because you want our land. We are standing in your way. You want us to run away massively to other countries so that you can take the land. And if we don't, then you're going to call us Amalek and eradicate us and murder us. Mm-hmm. Come on. This comes out of the worst. Like, I mean, even a science fiction writer who wanted to invent the worst, most evil people would make them say things like that and do things like that. And this is not science fiction. It's not a myth like that bastard said. This is what is actually happening right now as we speak, all the time, across the border in Lebanon and across the border in Gaza. And the killing just goes on and on and on and on. And with every killing they do, they feel good about it. And that's not me saying that. That's them saying that. Ask them. Look at them. Watch them on TikTok. They're loving it. They think they're doing a wonderful thing. That guy who said, yeah, I shot a 12-year-old girl and I killed her. I shot her right through the head. But ha, 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 I was actually looking for a baby. That soldier was killed 3 or 4 days ago in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But he isn't the only one who talks that way. And why does he talk that way? Because when he talks that way, his people go, yay, you're cool. And this we can't imagine. You can't imagine that. I can't imagine that. Because we don't have a psychopath culture. So we can't think that way. We can't take our brain to that level and think, oh, well, you know, if it was the other way around, we would do that. Because for instance, yes, even Joe Biden said that he saw videos of beheaded babies. Look, the first second that they told that story, me and every other Palestinian in the world knew, come on, what the fuck? Not true. Yeah, because we know that our people just don't do that. It just goes against what we believe in. It is not what we do. Okay, there is no way Palestinians from that faction specifically, especially that faction, because they're so religious that they wouldn't violate those rules, they would never go and behead 40 babies. They would never go and gang rape women, as was accused. And all of that turned out to be bogus. The Hannibal directive was used. And I can tell you, I don't have proof, but I know that Hamas just wanted to break through the fence, take hostages, preferably soldiers, preferably. And they fought mostly soldiers as well. And they took people. And then the Israeli army are responsible for the vast majority of those dead. And that did come out. And, you know, Max Blumenthal and many others have you know, investigated that and given proof and evidence. And the rest of the story, even when the lie has already been debunked, it just keeps getting repeated and repeated and repeated. This is very interesting. This is typically Zionist, by the way. You lie, okay? Somebody debunks the lie. You just ignore the debunking. You just lie again. You just keep repeating it. Netanyahu said it 2 days ago when he was talking about, when he was angry with Macron. Again, he said, beheaded babies, rape. He knows that it works. So he does it. He knows that the people, it was debunked to a certain group of people. He doesn't care about these people. He's not talking to them now. He's talking to the people who still believe it. So he just repeats it.
Yeah.
And that's how the game is.
So I guess we got a couple more minutes before I got to let you go. But I wanted to stress this one point. And I'm sure you'll agree with it, that I think one of the reasons why it's so important to focus on the U.S.-Israeli relationship is because Israel, and specifically Netanyahu, has been very, very, very responsible in a lot of the Middle Eastern policies that have really ruined a lot of this country and a lot of the Middle East over the last, 25 years. I mean, I don't believe in the death penalty, but I'm just saying there's some people that really make me question that premise because of how sincerely evil they are. I mean, you can't overstate that. Somebody that lobbies for another country to send their well-meaning men and women, children, I mean, kids who are 18 years old, to go out and die on his behalf so he can have, hegemony over this specific reason or region. I just cannot overestimate or overstate how evil that is in my estimation. So I got two more questions for you. Well, three more, but how do you think this election from the US is going to play out? Because we keep hearing from Donald Trump that Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer, who is a lifelong Zionist, they're all Palestinians, bad Palestinians. And then we hear from Trump that he wants to nuke Iran, every single major city. He wants to bomb the shit out of them. He ran the anti-war. Donald Trump said that he's going to bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, which is even more bodacious than the most wicked neocons back in the early 2000s. So I know I'm throwing a lot at you here, but how do you see Kamala Harris or Donald Trump kind of continuing this disaster in the Middle East? Because we keep hearing that Donald Trump is just going to solve it all.
Well, my answer is actually quite easy, because I wish that all of you, and literally all of you, would listen to John Mearsheimer just for half an hour. And he says they're Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and he's 100% right. Every time they ask him, what do you think, how do you think the outcome of the American elections will influence what happens in the Middle East? And he says there's no difference. And he's very right about that.
Right.
I think it's very important to read his book about the Israel lobby, and then you understand that actually it may seem that POTUS is so important and that he makes all the decisions, but he probably has some influence, but he's pushed around into so many directions by lobby groups. And when it comes to the Israel lobby, that one is so powerful that he has zero say in it. And what is a better illustration than Netanyahu himself coming to Congress and forcing people to give him 58 standing ovations? There is not one other American figure, a real American figure, could never get 58 standing ovations. Nobody. Right. I mean, no one could get even 12 standing ovations in, speaking that language.
Was it not even Zelensky got that many?
Not even Zelensky. Not even Zelensky. And he was the biggest, he was paraded around the most. Now, Zelensky doesn't have the influence, of course, that Netanyahu, because he's a puppet himself. Mm-hmm. But Netanyahu is the puppeteer, and he showed it. He was the puppeteer. He was standing there. He was like, okay, clap now. And then even when they applauded him, when it wasn't actually, this is the one where you shouldn't. And, he made like an irritated move, like, this is when you shouldn't clap, because I'm saying something now which isn't good, which isn't for an applause. He commands Washington. So if he commands Washington, then why are you holding elections? And I mean, like Tweedledee or Tweedledum, one wants abortion, one doesn't. It's going to be about these things. But if it comes to the Middle East, it's 100%. I like how Mearsheimer says Tweedledee and Tweedledum. George Galloway says two cheeks of the same arse. So, so you know, it's the same. It's the same. It doesn't matter. And so it's a bit frustrating for me to watch all that going. And you know, it's fine with me because I know that some people, you know, have certain preferences. It's just that I don't think that's that is going to affect us at all. And I find it sometimes sad that some Arab Americans are falling into the trap of that Trump is the anti-war guy. And I hope that when he said, well, you know, just nuke the facilities or just hit the nuclear facilities. Of course, you got to do that first and worry about the rest later. I hope that when he said that, they were like in shock and like, okay, now we don't know what to do anymore. And if they then decide not to vote, I don't know what the exact consequences of that are, but you know, just vote green. What the hell difference does it make? I mean, even if you don't agree with all these things, there really isn't another candidate as anti-genocide as that. Teach the American system a lesson, okay? And then maybe next round you can have some serious elections. You never know, because you might actually change something.
Yeah. All right. So I only got you for a few more minutes. So the two things I want to ask you, first of all, what is your favorite guitar?
My favorite guitar, like my favorite specific guitar, like the favorite guitar that I have.
Yes. The favorite one that you have.
Oh, all right. Okay. That's actually, it's a classic now because it's a Dion. I don't know if you know Dion. It was a brand of Japanese guitars in the late 70s and beginning of the 80s. And they made very high end, high quality, very refined guitars made of you know, I think my guitar is made of like five different types of wood, and it's got copper everywhere, and it's the Dion Power Mark XX. That's my favorite guitar.
I'm gonna have to look that up. My two favorites are Paul Reed Smith and Jericho. Paul Reed Smith is obviously a real big one here in America. And then Jericho is a little bit of a smaller company. They're in Texas. I think they've been around for like 8 years, but I just found out about them. And then I bought a couple of their guitars. I'm like, oh my God, I love these things.
Wow. So, is the fretboard or what makes them, or the sound?
Yes, it's all of it.
It's all of that.
Yeah. So this is probably one of my favorites.
Wow. Wow, man.
I'm going to try to get that headstock in real quick. There we go.
You want me to pick up my Dion or not?
Actually, yeah, go ahead. And then, that neck joint, too. Second. Yeah. I'm eagerly awaiting this. Oh, look at that. Wow. Oh, that is gorgeous.
See all the finishing.
Oh my God. Yes, that is beautiful. Even the neck joint is perfect.
Yeah. And it plays nice too. Sounds good too.
I could tell just by looking at it. Doc, this has sincerely been an incredible conversation. I always enjoy these conversations, talking to people who live a world away, as the title of the show says. So why don't you let everybody know where they could find you, your music, and if they want to support you, all that good stuff.
All right. So, I mean, I'm on Twitter, on X. You can find me through Kyle probably. Mm-hmm. And it's at Doc Jazz Music is as one word. You find in my bio, there's a link which gives you, brings you to my SoundClick repository where I have most of my songs. Actually, it's the biggest number of them. But I'm also on YouTube, on Spotify, and Apple Music, and all the other ones. So I think I'm pretty easy to find.
Nice. All right. Well, Doc, I'm glad we could have this conversation. Let's definitely do it again sometime. And if you've got anything else, we'll close her out there.
Wonderful. It's been really, really, really nice conversation. I think we would get along if we met in real life.
I sincerely believe that.
We would have a good time and maybe play together a bit.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. We would jam some Gary Moore or something like that. Gary Moore, ZZ Top or something.
Yeah, good one. Good one. Good choice. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take care.
Thanks, man. Bye. Mm-hmm.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.